Today is Friday, June 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Over 150 years ago today, African-American slaves in Texas learned they were finally free.
The protests around the death of George Floyd has brought racial equality to the forefront of the conversation in the United States.
So why are Americans still protesting racial inequality?
Much of our history has been suppressed.
Plus, grassroots groups support refugees as they struggle to build new lives. We'll have those stories and more next. June 19th, or Juneteenth, is observed by many Americans as the day in 1865 when the last slaves in America were told that the Civil War had ended and that they were now free. But this year, strikes and protests may accompany barbecues and celebrations amid a national uprising to demand racial justice. The AP's Mike Gracia starts us off.
It is Juneteenth, the day that commemorates when the last enslaved Americans learned they were free 155 years ago.
Juneteenth is actually the day that African Americans can celebrate their independence.
George Washington University professor Jesse Holland notes this Juneteenth is unlike any other.
The protests around the death of George Floyd has brought racial equality to the forefront of the conversation in the United States.
Though not yet a federal holiday, Juneteenth is recognized in all but three states, Hawaii, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Mike Gracia, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump is scheduled to hold his first large indoor campaign rally since much of the U.S. banned large gatherings because of the coronavirus pandemic in early March. He returns to the campaign trail in Tulsa, Oklahoma tomorrow, June 20th. Oklahoma is a solidly Republican state that voted overwhelmingly for Trump in 2016, and he repeatedly campaigned there during that election cycle. The rally was originally scheduled to take place today, June 19th, but that announcement created an outpouring of criticism. Republicans say that President Trump didn't know about the significance to African Americans of June 19th or Tulsa, and ultimately Trump decided to change the date of the rally. As global protests continue to confront years of inequality and systemic racism, I spoke with Dr. Scott Ellsworth, a professor in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan on Skype, about the two events that sparked the controversy. We just heard about Juneteenth, but what about Tulsa, Oklahoma, the rally's location?
The Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 was the single largest incident of racial violence in American history. It happened during a very perilous time for African Americans, an era of lynching, of the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan, which was the largest terrorist organization in American history. But there were some events that happened in Tulsa. There was an incident in an elevator between an African American male teenager and a white American elevator operator. We don't know what happened actually in the elevator, but the next day, one of Tulsa's afternoon newspapers, the Tulsa Tribune, published an inflammatory article saying it was an interracial rape attempt. And they also published an editorial entitled "To Lynch Negro Tonight." And within a half an hour of that paper coming out, a lynch mob started to gather downtown at the Tulsa courthouse. The mob grew over the hours, 200, 300, 500, 1,000. Then around 10:30 at night, a group of African-American World War I veterans, all armed, went down to the courthouse, presented themselves to the sheriff, said, "We're here to help defend the prisoner." They were turned away, but as they went, an elderly white man tried to disarm one of the black vets. A shot was fired, and the race massacre began.
Now, as I understand it, ultimately, the National Guard was called in around the 1st of June to kind of put things to rest. Is that correct?
That's correct. The state troops, the National Guard troops from Oklahoma City, were called in, but there were local units of the National Guard who were involved early. But by the time the state troops had arrived, Tulsa's black community known as Greenwood had already been largely destroyed. A mob of whites, we don't know how big, maybe 5,000, invaded the black neighborhoods, looting and burning more than 1,000 homes and businesses to the ground.
In a statement to VOA, The Oklahoma National Guard called the events in 1921 nothing short of horrific. And while there are widely varying accounts of the role played by the National Guard during the rioting, the truth of the matter is that many of Tulsa's white citizens committed atrocious acts against their neighbors and guardsmen. However, the historical record shows that a handful of brave guardsmen protected the Tulsa Armory and the weapons inside from more than 300 white rioters. The actions of these guardsmen substantially reduced the number of murders in the Greenwood District. And in the days following the riots, Oklahoma guardsmen restored the order to the area and prevented further attacks by both black and white Tulsans. So that was 1921. This is 2020. It's 99 years after the race riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 150 plus years after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. And this is coming at a time where we have worldwide protests addressing inequality and systemic racism. So I guess the question I have for you, and it's a very difficult one, why are we still having these kinds of conversations, you know, so many years after the fact?
Well, I think one reason is, I mean, there's a couple reasons. One reason is that much of our history has been suppressed. There are certain versions of American history that school children learn, and oftentimes some of the more darker spots are wiped away and people don't know about them. So that's been a process. The White Race Massacre was actively suppressed for decades. It's been a long process to get that story out. The other is that, you know, American society is far from perfect, but there's been a lot of change, certainly been great changes in my lifetime. So as people start to learn more and get a more accurate and fuller picture of our nation's past, I think people are starting to question what it is that we as a nation should do today.
So is education the primary way to address this?
I think it's a very important way to address it, but I also think we have a larger problem, which is America is a nation that is obsessed by race. Americans think about race when they go out the front door, what neighborhood they're going to, when they walk into a room, and we talk about it. But the problem is, it's we tend to talk about it only with people who look like us. And we are still a segregated society by school districts, by churches, by neighborhoods. What we need to do is to start having honest face-to-face conversations about race with people who don't look like us, to be able to listen, to understand their perspective, not to be accusatory. And I think once we have a better idea as to where we've been and where we're at, we'll have a better plan for where we should go in the future.
Dr. Scott Ellsworth worked with the lead scholars for the Tulsa Race Riot Commission and has been involved with ongoing efforts to secure compensation for survivors. He teaches at the University of Michigan. China has released genome sequencing data for the coronavirus responsible for a recent outbreak in Beijing, with officials saying it identified a European strain based on preliminary studies. Reuters' Emer McCarthy reports China has sent the information to the World Health Organization.
Details published on China's National Microbiology Data Center website revealed the Beijing genome data was based on three samples, two human and one environmental, collected on June 11. Wu Zunyu, the chief epidemiology expert for the Chinese Center of Disease Control, told state media this week the Beijing strain was similar to Europe's, although not necessarily directly transmitted from European countries. Wu did not elaborate on those comments made before the genome data release.
Emer McCarthy reports for Reuters News. There are currently over 8.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 worldwide. That's according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. Clover Biopharmaceuticals has become the sixth Chinese developer of a potential COVID-19 vaccine to move into human trials, launching a study in Australia Friday that will test its vaccine with boosters. Chinese prosecutors have charged two detained Canadians with spying in an apparent bid to step up pressure on Canada to drop a U.S. extradition request for a Huawei executive. Michael Kovrig has been charged on suspicion of spying for state secrets and intelligence, and Michael Spavor was charged on suspicion of spying for a foreign entity and illegally providing state secrets. Both men were detained shortly after Canada detained Meng Wanzhou in December of 2018 at the request of U.S. authorities who want her on fraud charges related to trade with Iran. China has denied any explicit link, but Chinese diplomats have strongly implied a connection between Meng's case and those of the two Canadians. Still to come.
We go through the whole rebuilding a life activities with a family from the time they arrive, finding housing, taking care of doctor's appointments and getting them enrolled in school. All of the things to help them resettle here to make it a little easier.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international team of astronomers has discovered what they say is the youngest magnetar found so far. The object was first detected back in March with NASA's Neil Gehrels Swift Observatory as an enormous burst of X-rays. Follow-up studies by the team has determined that the object is a magnetar, a special type of neutron star with an extremely powerful magnetic field. The astronomers estimate that this magnetar's magnetic field is up to 1 trillion times stronger than Earth's. The magnetar is located between 15 to 16,000 light years away and is being observed as it was when it was 240 years old, a mere blip on an astronomical timeline. This means that the birth of this mighty magnetar could have been observed by someone on Earth back in 1780. A neutron star is the tiny, dense, and very bright remainder of a massive star that exploded in a supernova. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. South Korean President Moon Jae-in on Friday accepted the resignation of the minister responsible for relations with North Korea as tensions with Pyongyang rise over the activities of defectors in the South and stalled diplomacy. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan has the details.
South Korean Unification Minister Kim Yeon-chul, who oversees engagement with North Korea, had offered to step down on Wednesday, making himself accountable for worsening ties. Pyongyang has taken issue over defectors in the South, sending propaganda leaflets, food and medicine via balloons and bottles thrown into the sea over the border into North Korea. The defectors have been asked to abandon their campaign, and the foreign ministry has threatened to impose penalties for violations of a law governing inter-Korean exchanges. North Korea has rejected offers from the South for dialogue amid stalled diplomacy. Direct criticism of South Korea from Pyongyang's leadership has slowed in the past 2 days, but state media has continued to deliver a flurry of reports of North Koreans, quote, exploding with anger at the South. Meanwhile, in the U.S., a senior Pentagon official said on Thursday, North Korea continues to pose an extraordinary threat to the Asia-Pacific region, and said it was difficult to tell what they would do in the coming days and weeks. It marks a further blow to President Donald Trump's hopes of persuading North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons and open up to the world.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Friday that a major cyber attack by a sophisticated state-based actor is targeting government, industry, and political parties. Phil Mercer reports Morrison said the attempted intrusions have been intensifying in recent months, but he would not say who was responsible.
Morrison said the cyber attack on Australia has been sustained and widespread, affecting all levels of government, political parties, essential services and businesses. He said it had been going on for months and had become more frequent. Asked if China might be responsible because of worsening bilateral relations, he wouldn't say who was to blame.
What I can confirm with confidence, based on the advice, the technical advice that we've received, is that this is the actions of a state-based actor with significant capabilities, and there aren't too many state-based actors who have those capabilities. This is part of the new world we live in. Regrettably, this is not peculiar.
Morrison says there have so far been no large-scale breaches of personal or official data. Businesses and government agencies are being urged to upgrade their online defences. Technical advice on how to detect and mitigate threats is also being provided. Australia's Parliament was hit last year by a malicious intrusion on its computer networks. Reports said that Australian intelligence agencies suspected China's Ministry of State Security. The government in Canberra refused to comment. Australia's relationship with China, its biggest trading partner, is lucrative but complex. Ties have been strained by allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic affairs. Canberra's vocal push for a global investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, which first emerged in Wuhan, infuriated Beijing. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The White House has been working to block the release of former National Security Advisor John Bolton's book next week. In the book, Bolton asserts that U.S. President Donald Trump engaged in interactions with various world leaders, including China's Xi Jinping, to undermine national interests for his own political gain. The Justice Department filed a request for an emergency court order Wednesday to block publication of Bolton's book, a day after filing a lawsuit on Tuesday to potentially stop its publication. The administration argues that Bolton breached non-disclosure agreements and was risking national security. Craig Albert is the director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia. He suggests the move isn't so much about protecting secrets, but rather protecting hesitant 2020 Trump voters.
I think the audience that most people are worried about right now about switching opinions are those reluctant Trump voters from 2016 or Republicans who are right now, you know, teetering on whether or not to support Trump in 2020. And there's a large contingency of Republicans that are abandoning ship right now. And even though the president touts his polls as being, you know, 90 or 95% approval amongst Republican Party members, more people are leaving the Republican Party, or Republicans are just choosing not to vote for the president because of the way he's handling this racial injustice and the protests and what's been happening with that. And I'm talking about some of those groups of Republican voters against Trump, for instance, really being spearheaded by folks like Bill Kristol, for instance. And so that is a constituency that President Trump does not want to lose, but that seems to be leaving the Republican Party in large numbers, or at least leaving the idea of voting for Trump and might cast their vote for Joe Biden. So for those individuals that are thinking about those 2016 voters who voted for Trump, that are Republicans, who are on the fence about voting for him this time, this is something else that might add or give them reason not to vote for Trump. And that could be very damaging to his reelection campaign.
What's your take on what the entire controversy is regarding this alleged, you know, national security and classified information that's playing out in the public discourse right now?
Well, from what I can gather, it seems as if there are some things in the book that the president or some people at the White House don't want released. We don't know the details of what that is, but I doubt it's anything related to serious national security concerns or classified materials, because what's being lost in the news cycle right now is that John Bolton did have the book pre-reviewed already, and the White House was not satisfied with that pre-review selection, and so they wanted to do it again under the national security staff. So they asked the Department of Justice to do it a second time by someone in the National Security Office. So it's already been done once, and John Bolton changed things, took out quotations that were attributed to the president and things of that nature. So it's been cleared once. The president or someone at the White House was not satisfied with that, and so they wanted it done a second time. The interesting thing here is that the president, and the laws on this are murky, the president does have the right to pretty much say something is privileged information or classified almost carte blanche. He can choose what he wants to be classified or not. And so it seems as though that might be the process of what's going on at this point. And we don't know what he's trying to make classified.
Craig Albert is a professor at Augusta University, where he's the director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies. A top U.S. general says the United States has reduced its troop level to 8,600 in Afghanistan, fulfilling the first phase of the planned withdrawal specified in the U.S. Taliban deal that was signed in Doha back in February. The U.S. Taliban agreement also calls for the full withdrawal of U.S. military from the country by May of 2021 if the Taliban meets the conditions of the deal, including severing ties with terrorist groups. Saturday is World Refugee Day, a day to honor the struggles and courage tens of millions of people who have been forced to flee their homes due to conflict or natural disaster. Although the number of refugees the U.S. government receives has shrunk under U.S. President Donald Trump, community volunteer groups continue to offer refugees the practical support they need to build a new life for themselves. To learn more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kathy O'Callaghan, founder and president of Hearts and Homes for Refugees via Zoom. A volunteer-driven group in Westchester County, New York, has been working with the U.S. State Department and others since 2016 to welcome, assist, and advocate for refugees. O'Callaghan says it can be an emotional experience.
Well, it has to be emotional to start, but it's also very practical. We go through the whole rebuilding a life activities with a family from the time they arrive, finding housing, taking care of doctor's appointments and getting them enrolled in school, all of the things to help them resettle here to make it a little easier. But there's also work that we do that's shorter term. You know, we're not getting as many refugees in this country and we're not resettling as many. So volunteers match with families and individuals who are already here but face bumps in the road. So whether it's a mentoring or backpacks for kids or clothing or school supplies, anything that a family needs from time to time.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from refugees? They must be thrilled.
I think people are very grateful. Some of these relationships are very contractual. Thank you very much for the 3 months of support. We've had an interesting one where a young woman, we helped her just with initial needs and ended up helping her get ready for college. She wants to be a doctor and she wants to be a woman's doctor. She's from Central African Republic and she was a victim of female genital mutilation.
I imagine that most, if not all, refugees have been somewhat traumatized along the way.
You're right. So we go through a lot of training. We manage our expectations as volunteers without overpromising. But the volunteers understand that we have so much in common with refugees, and the thing that separates us is our circumstances. It's easy to work with someone or to help someone or to be a volunteer when what you see is a mother and a father, someone trying to do what any of us would want, to take care of our family, and we'd want to live in safety and we'd want to thrive. And that's what we can relate to as volunteers.
What generally motivates people to volunteer with you in the first place?
For many people, it's a moral imperative. For some people, it's what their faith calls them to do. Or their values as Americans, they're people of goodwill.
Sounds like in their own way, volunteers get almost as much from this program as the refugees do.
Yeah, it's so true. I've had more volunteers say to me, this has been the most meaningful work. The local response to a global crisis can change the world. That's what powers Hearts and Homes for Refugees.
The larger community benefits from this too.
Everyone is enriched when others come into the community and bring their culture and their work.
Can you give me an example? I know you have these picnics where former and present refugees and volunteers and alumni all come and have some fun together.
Oh, I can give you an example. One of the families is from the Gambia, a wonderful family, and they were an asylum-seeking family and have stayed in touch. They are amazing cooks, and they were so excited to come to Westchester from the Bronx, and they came completely dressed in their beautiful, colorful clothing from their country, and they brought food, and they were the hit. They talked about their food, and they were did little dancing and they talked about their color clothing. And for us, it's so unusual, but for them, that's the way they dress. They're used to that kind of beauty.
And did you serve them good old American hot dogs?
We actually had pizza. It's amazing how American ways become very quickly adopted by newcomers and our new neighbors.
So what are your thoughts for World Refugee Day 2020?
Given the conditions, we have the lowest number of refugees being admitted to this country in the history of the program. And contributing to that is growing racist and xenophobic and nationalistic attitudes. And piled onto that is a pandemic. They are suffering as victims again. So it's time we stand up and make our voices heard even louder.
Kathy O'Callaghan is the president and director of Hearts and Homes for Refugees, and she was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.